This is a recording of a live Resolution Foundation event. We hope you find it some combination of interesting or entertaining. To read the research and access the event slides referenced in this episode, please visit the events section of our website. Good morning, everybody. Happy 2022. It's going to be a mess, I'll be honest. I'm not sure what's going to happen. There's apparently the back end of this pandemic thing going on. The economy is going all over the place because all our bills are going up. And I thought that those two things were going to be the things that came together to drive politics. But the last weekend has shown that other things may indeed get involved in British politics, like Boris Johnson's personality, who drank which lukewarm Chardonnay back in early 2020. So who knows? But it's going to be a lot to talk about. Whatever. We thought, you know, given all of that going on, it'd be good to get ourselves together at the beginning of the year-ish to think ahead about how the politics, the economics and the pandemic might come together over the next few months. Obviously, as always, some of this is about futurology, so you're not allowed to come back and hold us to account for all of this in a few months' time. But anyway, but that is the plan, and to help us do that, and we're going to take these in turn in the way that I thought the year was going to shape out, but may not turn out to be how the year shapes out. We're going to take this in turn by first of all focusing on the pandemic, or what might become the epidemic, then on what that means for the economics, and then how those two things come together to give us the politics, in brackets, along with everything else causing it. And to do that, first of all, I'm Torsten Bell, the Chief Executive of Resolution Foundation. I'm going to show you a few slides about why it might be a messy year. Then you're going to hear from John Murdoch-Brown, who is the Chief Data Reporter at the Financial Times and the guru of very long, sometimes depressing, sometimes uplifting tweets about what's going on in the data for this pandemic, but have helped lots of us get through the last 2 years in trying to work out what is going on. So thank you very much indeed for that. And then on the economics, you're going to hear from Stephanie Flanders, Head of Bloomberg Economics and previously everything under the sun, who's going to tell us what's going on. And importantly, probably hopefully bring some of the international side into that, because, you know, it turns out oil prices are not just determined in the UK. And then you're going to hear from Stephen Bush, who's currently the political editor of The New Statesman and co-host of The New Statesman podcast and manages to write the Daily Politics newsletter. So he hasn't had any sleep for about X years. But he's soon about to join the Financial Times as an associate editor and weekly columnist. So congratulations on that, Stephen. So that is the plan. As ever, those of you at home can get involved by asking questions, and we're going to have some moderately tongue-in-cheek polls to vote on as well. And the hashtag is New Year on Slido. So log into Slido, hashtag New Year, and we'll bring things up there as we go. Right, so that is the plan. So to kick us off, I'm going to show you a few slides. These are only moderately meant to be surprising for those of you that have been paying any attention for the recent past. But I think it is worth pushing ourselves on the level of volatility that is around at the moment. So I'm going to put us back to 6 months ago, to the middle of 2021, and have a look at what was going on with the pandemic, the economics and the politics back then, and what that made us think. So back in mid-2021, May, there were basically no COVID cases. 2,000, which maybe we would have thought was a lot at some point, but broadly we were at no cases. We hadn't yet got to the June-July pickup in cases that we saw over the summer, and we basically lived through the autumn. So basically we'd won. There were lots of headlines saying Boris Johnson says the epidemic is over, the pandemic is over. On the economy, we had 1% inflation. This is actually the latest data we had in May 2021, so this was actually for March. But broadly, remember, and we should remember this, at the beginning of last year, we had under 1% inflation right the way through at the beginning of last year. We all thought there was absolutely zero problem with inflation, which again points to how useful forecasts are. In fact, some of it, we thought there was zero inflation, despite it actually being arithmetically impossible in some ways that low inflation was going to last. But we still all managed it, including people like the Bank of England and the Fed. So it turns out even well-paid people can't count. And on the politics, this was soon after Hartlepool, which may come to be seen as the peak of Johnsonianism. The Tories were on 50% of the vote, admittedly not in every survey, so we may have picked a YouGov survey that gives you a particularly ludicrously high rate, but they were consistently over 40% in the polls in the middle of 2021, which isn't that long ago. The three things came together to give you headlines like this, because there's no representative of the Times here. I'm unfairly picking on the Times, but almost every front page ran a version of this story in May last year. And in fact, lots of them ran it again in September, which is PM's here for a decade. He's sitting astride. People wrote columns about how he was going to be sitting astride politics like something large on a motorway. I can't remember what it was. But basically, that he was going to completely dominate politics because the world had changed. This new coalition existed and only Boris Johnson could hold it together. And he would definitely be in power for 10 years. And Keir Starmer should choose whether he resigns before the summer or after the summer. And that was what British politics was about, particularly after the Hartlepool by-election in May. Right, where are we at the beginning of this year? The pandemic. So this is the 7-day average of case rates. So we're coming up towards 200,000 cases a day. You know, remember that's like 3 times the record, roughly, that we got this time last year. Like, so really high case rates. If you've managed to not get COVID, well done, you're a winner. And you're in a minority of people. Now, it should be said, the case rate is ticking down on a daily basis now, but the 7-day average is still really high. Inflation was 1.1% back in March 2021. It's now 4.6% in the latest data for November last year, and everyone's expecting it to hit over 6% by April this year. So huge turnaround in the picture on prices. And you know, we all spent the last 2 weeks when we weren't talking about parties, once we got relaxed about Omicron, talking about a cost of living crisis being the dominant theme of this year for the economics and the politics. And the Conservative vote share is now sitting at around, depending on the polls, let's not overreact to one set of polls this morning, which are showing huge falls in Tory support, but we're nearer 30 than 50%, should we say. So a very large change in Conservative voting, a slightly smaller change in Labour's vote share. I think we're up into the high 30s now, would be our average.
They're averaging about 38, which I think is an interesting... There's an interesting question there about the lid on the Labour vote.
Exactly. Anyway, but a big fall for the Tory vote anyway. And it's less clear that people are writing 10 more years of Boris, what's it all going to mean today than they were back in May or indeed September. So it's all changed. Life's volatile, pandemics are volatile, economic forecasts might not be volatile, but economics is. So that is what we're going to dwell on today. And we're going to try to dwell on the interactions between those things while also kind of getting at what our esteemed panel thinks about the individuals. So that's the plan. So to get us going on the pandemic itself, I'm going to hand over to John to give you a kind of live version of one of his tweet threads.
Thanks very much. Hopefully the live version will be slightly less rambling than some of the threads are. And it's about 15 hours earlier than I usually do some of those threads, which is nice as well. So I just want to give us a sort of situation report of where we are in the UK with COVID at the moment, a couple of little looks at what we can learn from other countries' experiences as well, and just what the next month might hold. And I should prefix that by saying that in terms of what the next month might hold, I was, in the middle of November, was quite happy that everything was heading to a pretty neat ending, and then Omicron landed. So, you know, my views on this are no more reliable than some guy down the pub, frankly. But with that caveat, let's have a look. So a natural place to start, again, this isn't the UK, but this is what we can probably expect to happen now in the next few weeks, is to look at what happened in South Africa, in particular in Gauteng province, where the Omicron variant first really took off. What we can see now with a bit of hindsight, their wave has largely concluded. Case numbers, test positivity, hospitalizations and deaths have all not only risen and peaked, but have fallen very steeply over the last few weeks. So we can sort of look at that as what an Omicron wave looks like when it's worked its way fully through a population. So we saw these much shorter, steeper peaks in all of these metrics than we'd seen in the past. And crucially, when we talk about the more acute, more severe outcomes like people needing hospitalisation or even people dying, those all peaked and fell from much, much lower levels than we had seen before. So in terms of deaths or even excess deaths, which gets around the fact that not all COVID deaths are picked up, the peak from the Omicron wave was somewhere in the region of 15% of where it had peaked during the Delta wave, for example. And again, the fact that it fell quickly also means the overall toll has been much shorter. So that's the sort of benchmark that we'll be comparing other countries' Omicron waves to, such as the UK's. In terms of the UK, the focus really has been on London, because as with anything that's new and interesting, it takes off in London first. And so what we saw with the Omicron variant...
It's going to be a controversial statement.
Absolutely, but you know, it is what it is. We're all here in Westminster, so what can we say? So case levels in London, as Torsten was saying, we've seen across the country as a whole, shot up well above what we'd become accustomed to over the last couple of years. The number of people being hospitalised for COVID also rose, but as you can see from the chart here, reached a much lower ceiling. And the good news is that although we have seen, in sheer volume terms, large numbers of people both infected and hospitalised with COVID, severe disease as measured by the number of people requiring ventilation or indeed losing their lives seems to be peaking at a much, much lower level than in the past. So to the extent that London is an indicator of what we'll see in the rest of the UK, and the evidence so far is that will largely be true, it does look like this wave is very acute in terms of the number of people are being infected, but it's very, very, very different to anything we've seen in the past, especially last winter, in terms of severe disease and death, which is obviously very good news. Another statistic we've been looking at is in terms of the total load that hospitals are coming under is the number of people in ICU for any reason. So whether this is COVID or something else, this gives an idea of how many people are really ill in really severe need of medical help in the UK at the moment. And again, in London, we're seeing something that looks very, very different to last winter. So the NHS is under pressure this winter, as it is indeed under pressure in most winters. But this year, COVID seems to be playing less of a role in that than it certainly was last winter. The latest data we have on that is what I'm showing in this chart. So this is the number of people who are being admitted to hospital for COVID, or the number of people in hospital being treated for COVID. And we're looking at the growth rate over time. So you see these lines going upwards and then coming back down. That's the growth rate in hospitalizations peaking and then falling. And indeed, just over the last couple of days, hospitalizations of people who tested positive for COVID are actually now flat or falling in almost all parts of England. It's only in the northeast and Yorkshire where we're still seeing significant growth, and indeed there the growth rate has been slowing for some time now. So it does look like, to the extent that COVID has added pressure to hospitals this winter, that too now seems to be probably at its peak and falling. So if hospitals have got this far, then it looks like, fingers crossed, we should be okay for the next month or so as well. Another good sign is that there had been some fears that, because like most waves, the Omicron wave was spreading primarily through young people at first, there were fears that, well, okay, even if cases are now falling overall, perhaps there is still additional load coming in for the NHS because older people, who are the most vulnerable, are lagging slightly behind. But the evidence there on hospitalizations across England shows that even there, among the elderly, the numbers of people being hospitalized with COVID is no longer rising. It's leveled off over the last few days, and it's only among children, school-aged children, that we're still seeing a slight rise in hospitalizations. And even there, the absolute numbers and rates remain very low. So lots of evidence here that both in terms of infections and in terms of pressure on hospitals, we're probably at or perhaps even slightly coming down from the peak of the Omicron wave. There are a couple of caveats around that, though, and one of them is how our own behavior has impacted this. And I'm sure everyone will have experienced this in late December, in the week or so coming up to Christmas. Social calendars were pretty much wiped out. Everyone was cancelling things left, right and centre. Even though there was no support provided for the hospitality sector, lots of places voluntarily took the decision to close because they had their calendars went from fully booked to fully vacant. And I think this is going to be interesting to see what happens in the next couple of weeks, because across all four nations of the UK, we did see this very marked drop off, both in terms of people going to work, people using public transport, and people going out to shops, cafes, restaurants, bars, you name it. So that must have had, just from a common sense basis, some impact on the spread of the virus. That has probably played a partial role in the downturn of transmission that we've seen over the last couple of weeks. So the interesting thing over the next week or two will be that as we see, well, as all of us do things like going into Westminster to do panels and going to pubs, going to bars, going to parties, it'll be interesting to see what impact that has on case rates again. And the other thing to note, obviously, is that although case rates have been falling now for several days, if not a couple of weeks, among most age groups, among children, they are starting to tick up. And this is before we're really seeing the impact of the return to school as well. So it's quite likely that certainly among children, we will see case rates and possibly hospitalizations rise, continue to rise over the next couple of weeks. My personal sense is that overall at the population level, that is likely to mean a slight sort of bump or interruption in an overall downward trend, rather than a sort of more broad-based rise to a second peak. But again, who knows what we'll see. But I'll just end as well with a quick look across the Atlantic to the US, where the situation at the moment is quite different. And I think this just shows that in terms of the pandemic's impact on society and economies, that we are going to see perhaps a more varied pattern over the next month or so across the world than we've seen before. Because the US is still seeing not only cases, but hospitalizations and ICU occupancy reach pretty much record levels across the whole pandemic. And indeed, death numbers in the US from COVID are currently at about 50% of their all-time record, whereas in the UK, they're below 20%. So to the extent that things are looking good here, that does look pretty solid, but that doesn't necessarily mean the same will happen across the world.
Thank you very much indeed, John.
Well, you have to clap because there's no audience here.
Well,
that's it. Good enthusiasm. Well done. Almost like this is a real event with humans spilling out onto the streets. They're so cute. Right, John, that was very perky for you compared to your average. If I took you the mean John perkiness over the last 2 years, this is like well above average.
I think it's the company that, you know, bring that out for me.
Okay, well, yeah, I think that's a good reaction. Right, Stephanie, so that is what is kind of, there's kind of good news going on. Are you all perky on the economy too?
Well, so I think if you look right now, it's brilliant to get all the numbers on the Omicron, because it's been certainly in the US, I think people have been taken aback by just the immediacy of the impact, and then they just can't work out how long it's going to last. So just one fun fact for you, which you would already know, but it took 10 months for the US to have its first 10 million cases. And the last 10 million, which took them up to 60 million, took a month. And that was all Omicron. And as you say, it is having a bit more of an impact on the public health front than it has here. But what is extraordinary is this sort of absenteeism that we've already seeing in our high activity data, about a 16% hit to activity in the US, which is, you know, on a par with the beginning of the first wave. But we agree with you that we think it's that economic impact, even in the US, even though it's having different health consequences, should peak in February. And so you're sort of talking about a one quarter thing. So if we can get past that and think about how policymakers have been thinking about this year, you could say, you know, this is the year where we're sort of testing out whether the economy is kind of strong enough and normal enough to live without the extraordinary fiscal monetary support that has been given over the last few years. And in a sense, I think by and large, policymakers are assuming that the economy is strong enough to take a really significant withdrawal of fiscal support. I mean, it's massive in the US, but actually here, I was just checking the numbers, you know, we're halving borrowing on a cyclical basis. And, you know, whacking up taxes by several percentage points of GDP in 1 year, reducing spending by a similar amount. You know, the numbers are even bigger in the US, obviously, because you had that extra stimulus from Biden. And it looks like he's not going to get his extra round of slightly more longer term spending this year, thanks to recalcitrant senators. So you've got a big fiscal withdrawal, admittedly following a massive fiscal push. You have interest rates going up. Belatedly, some would say, and if you had sort of stripped away all this concern about energy prices, and it's particularly if you're not sitting in Europe, you tend to think, you know, that's the big story for this year. Is all of that either going to be too much for the economy, or actually not enough given the inflationary dynamics that are ongoing? I think the wild card in the UK, and that's a question for every country, I think, the wild card for the UK, and to less extent other parts of Europe, is that we're reaching that stage, but we also have this massive hit to energy price, to cost of living, from not just that, but also from the energy price rise. And we were just looking at the numbers across Europe. In fact, funnily enough, as I do, I had a chat with the French finance minister a couple of days ago.
We're all doing that stuff.
Who was explaining why, you know, the French people should be very excited by Emmanuel Macron's economic record. And it was interesting because, as some of you will know, they have capped the increase in retail energy costs to only a 4% increase this year. And initially they thought that was going to cost them 4 billion euros. Now it's 8 billion, and it's actually probably going to be much more than that. And they're trying to do a deal with the energy producers by the end of this week, by tomorrow, in fact, he promised me, to spread the burden of that cost. But he was adamant. I said, so what do you think? You know, would you say it was quite risky for a government to, you know, imagine that households could deal with these kind of double-digit energy prices? It's inconceivable. It's inconceivable that one could allow...
Even a French liberal isn't that liberal.
The economic risks of allowing the households, it's impossible to have 20, 30%. And I was like, yeah, well, it's 50% in the UK. Yes. So something is going to have to happen there because it is unique in Europe. If you look, Germany has much better organised wholesale buying patterns over multi-years, where actually investors are probably going to be the ones that take quite a lot of the hit. Basically everybody, as we all know, we've been through this for months, has a better system for dealing with this than we do. But it adds something, because if you didn't have that happening, you would have said, okay, it's an extraordinary squeeze, but we also have this extraordinary amount of excess savings sitting in household balance sheet, which by the standards of most savings is a bit more evenly distributed. It isn't just held by the top 20%, but it is certainly not. The people who are most hurt by the energy squeeze are not the ones who are sitting on excess cash. We know that. Resolution Foundation knows that better than anyone else. So I think there's a short-term concern around that. I would just say, and we'll get into this later, but I think the long-term kind of quandary for me is how we are basically assuming that this year's very messy, could be even messier in Westminster, but that at the end of the year, or certainly by the middle of 2023, economically speaking, the world kind of goes back to normal. And I find that jarring when I think of all the kind of micro conversations we have. You know, often the same economists who are having long discussions about how supply chains have been permanently changed, we've got potentially even a COVID dividend from the fact that productivity is going to rise, we've all working from home, digitalization has been accelerated, all these things have happened that have changed the way the economy works for better or worse. Inflationary dynamics now may be endemic in a way it wasn't before. We have all those conversations, but when we actually write our forecast, we sort of go, yeah, probably revert to mean.
Definitely 4% wage growth, 2% inflation, it'll be fine.
It's sort of boring to say it because we don't know the answer yet, but I think the chances of policymakers, certainly central banks, having screwed it up by the end of the year, very high. I just wish I knew which way they were going to screw it up. Too much or too little.
Oh, right, okay, fine. That's the opposite of ending on John's perk. You're like, it's going to go wrong, you just can't tell us how.
Well, I have my great confidence in policymakers. I think they'll screw it up. I just can't decide you know, how bad it's going to be and whether it's... I think I'm... Maybe because I've just recently talked to Larry Summers, who I should say, as a former employee and friend of his, was someone who a year ago was talking about...
Well, definitely, I promise we'll come back to inflation.
What a crank.
No, he did.
So some economists did forecast this, and perhaps because I've been more influenced by him, I have a feeling we'll be more worried about inflation in a year's time than we think now.
Okay, very good. We'll okay, right. Now, Stephen, in the good old days, the politics textbook said loads of stuff happens in the political cycle, but the economic cycle comes along and, like, crushes everything else in the long run. And then during the pandemic, we just thought, well, it's all just down to how the government's cope with the pandemic, and that's what determines how popular they are, and it's good to be an incumbent initially, and it's probably bad to be an incumbent if the thing drags on, which it now has. What on earth is going on? Because it is a complete dog's dinner.
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, I think in some ways what we're being reminded of is that the essential facts of British politics as they were in 2019 are still true, right? Voters are more volatile than they ever have been, because broadly once you flirt with a smaller party, whether it's the Lib Dems, Change UK, Brexit Party, UKIP, Uncle Tom Cobble, and all, I think Gina Miller's actually launching a new one, True and Fair, today. But once you sort of flit to a smaller party, you kind of get the taste for behaving like a marginal voter. So broadly, Labour voters who voted Lib Dem for the first time in 2005 are more flighty than ones who didn't. Conservative voters who voted UKIP are more flighty than ones who didn't. And this instability is the story of you know, 50% in hot, you know, 50% yep. in May, and not 50% right now. And the sort of big known unknown question in British politics is, you know, the fact that Labour vote has been more stable, right? Why can't the Labour Party reliably crest 40% in the polls? Is it the sort of lingering fears about Labour, no money left, financial crisis, those anxieties people traditionally have had about voting for the Labour Party? Is it that we now have sort of multi-party politics of this kind of weird sense where the Labour vote bobbles along in the high 30s, Lib Dem vote bobbles along in the 12%, Green vote bobbles along in 7%, boom, there's an election or a by-election, and then whichever one of the progressive parties is second absorbs all of the sort of local anti-conservative vote? Because those two scenarios are perfectly plausible in terms of the information we have available, but they would obviously have quite different impacts if there were an election. In some ways, actually, the fate of Boris Johnson feels like the most certain part of all this. I kind of find myself having this weird sense of solidarity with him, right? We both know that we're not going to be in the job we're in now at the end of the year. There are some questions about when the date of transition will happen. But of course, I have the much nicer position of knowing where I'm going to land next. But the difficulty for the Tory party is that just as it stretches credulity to imagine that Boris Johnson did not know that there was a party in his house, it's not a very good position for day one of your job if you're Rishi Sunak to have to explain that you're either so stupid that at no point during your job did you notice there were quite a lot of people up in the garden opposite, or you noticed but you didn't want to rock the boat. That's not a great first day for a new prime minister. And then even if you're someone like Liz Truss, you can say, oh, well, I was too busy, you know, being abroad striking trade deals. It feels pretty likely, doesn't it, that it's going to turn out and there's just been an endemic culture of having lockdown-breaking parties throughout the top of government. And therefore, I think the question lots of Conservatives have is, if you make this the resignation issue for this Prime Minister, do you just end up with an utterly hellish sort of 12 months of, oh, well, is that person going to have to go? Is that person going to have to go? So, you know, yeah, one MP said to me yesterday, said, look, unless you yearn for the return of Jeremy Hunt, which some MPs do, but this one did not, he said, unless you yearn for the return of Jeremy Hunt and or someone else who's outside the government, we've got to find a different pretext to get rid of him. And I think one of the big political trends of the first 6 months of this year will be the Conservative Party looking for that different pretext.
But isn't lying to Parliament enough?
Oh, but that, again, that's a bit of a difficult road, because it's lying to Parliament about this issue that they might then also have to tell
uncomfortable truths. But they haven't all yeah. actually gone and
they've
said,
not said yeah. anything.
We don't yeah. know anything. You know, there were no parties. I know nothing yeah. about parties.
But I think it does still keep the... I think they do need him to be the sin eater for the parties in general, for the lying, for having to front up for them, and for really for whoever comes in to be able to go, well, actually, I'm the response to the cost of living crisis. I'm the response to getting shellacked in the local elections, whatever kind of... Or indeed, I am the response to the quite ambitious net zero policy that the government has. We see David Frost having a go in the Telegraph on that today. Actually, one of the interesting things about PMQs last week was what were the majority of critical Tory questions? Yeah, questions like, are you going to end the moratorium on fracking on shale? What are we doing about our energy security? Because that's become sort of the respectable face of climate denialism in the United Kingdom is to go, I get it, it's a problem, but essentially I'm a climate NIMBY. Yeah, we don't have to have this change ourselves. And this is still a government which, we shouldn't forget, has lost its radical period, right? The bit in the life of Parliament where a government does controversial things and it thinks will pay off later, because instead it was fighting the pandemic. It's, I think, a big and difficult question for them is, can you get away with doing the sort of, oh, right, here's our reform to local government finance here, here's, with, you know, those sort of planting those seeds which you hope will pay off in 4 years' time in what is now effectively going to be a two-year normal Parliament? And seeing as that will be happening at the same time that Tory MPs will be looking for their pretext to get rid of Boris Johnson, it's going to be a wild ride.
A wild ride. There you go. You heard it there, guys. Stephanie's depressed, John's optimistic, and Stephen is ready for a wild ride. Now, you've all... I mean, we've got loads of great questions coming in, and we've got about 45 minutes to try to do justice to all of 2022, the politics, the economics. Don't worry, Stephanie, they're going to come up here so you can see the questions. You haven't got to guess. So unimaginatively, let's try to do this as the pandemic, the economy, and the politics, but let's like spend a lot of time on the interactions between them, and then we can decide in good Marxist sense which one is driving which as we go. So, John, let's start off with some questions for you that are on the specifics of what is going on. So we've got one from Tim, which is basically, is it all going to go to pot again because another virus, another variant turns up, and your relaxation from October will be just as wrong as your relaxation today, or the other way around, and it's all going to be really, really bad because another wave will turn up. So why don't you take that one, and then we're going to come on to isolation, because in the end, I mean, this does matter a lot for like the next few years of the economics.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think. And you know, you and I were chatting about this before the panel about do we naturally expect more with each subsequent variant for them to be less virulent? And I think the sort of consensus on that is still not necessarily, but in terms of realised virulence, like the actual impact it has on the population, I think all other things being equal, yes. You know, there's an immense amount of immunity built up in populations right now. The UK is probably one of the most immune countries going, you know, for good reasons and less good reasons, as it were. And so, you know, even if, you know, if the Delta variant, which at the time was a really, really bad variant, if something of that virulence popped up again today, we would still see, as we did in the UK, I think people forget this, the Delta wave in the UK was far, far smaller than anything we saw last winter, despite Delta being, by most accounts, slightly more inherently or intrinsically virulent than the Alpha variant, the UK's homegrown variant. So I think, like, we don't know, to be honest, but I think essentially what we can say is that the stuff that we've done to date in terms of vaccines, in terms of boosters, in terms of people who got infected and now have immunity from that, all help. Treatments that have come out as well, you know, we've got, as well as vaccines, we've actually got treatments that can now be given. Hospitals have got better at managing this. All of that means that I think it would take something pretty exceptional now to come along and blow that out of the water and mean that hospitals get in a really, really, really difficult position, you know, more than they have been over the last couple of weeks. And for us to get back to March 2020, I think would take a sort of much less than 1% risk. So, yeah, you know, again, anything can happen. I've been confident before and been had it all thrown back in my face. But I think there's a lot of sort of structural and health reasons now that we probably can expect the realised outcome of new variants to continue to be slightly less severe with each one.
Okay. So we don't need the people who say viruses just evolved to become less of a problem to be right. We just need our vaccines and our level of immunity to be maintained. And yeah, that will give us enough protection even if something nasty happens.
I think pretty much. And especially because we've seen that with, even though there's been waning of immunity, that the bulk of that has been realised in terms of our protection from being infected. Yeah. We're still seeing that most people who've had, especially people who've been boosted, but even people who've had two doses or one prior infection, still have much, much, much higher protection from severe disease than those who haven't. So, yeah, even if we get something exceptional, that should still hold up reasonably well.
Yeah. So it's not the flu. It's just a lot more like the flu after we've all either got it or had a lot of vaccines.
Yeah.
What do you think about the economy? Do you think, so like one reading of like the last 2.5 years is, 2 years, feels like it's gone on forever, is we have just got more used to it. Like the economy's just got a lot more used to it. And we may not have been vaccinated, yeah, but broadly that's what's happened.
No, and there's a much more adaptability. And actually you see it, you know, the sort of sublime to the ridiculous, but I would also, one of my colleagues was talking for my podcast, Stephanomics, about to a local pizza maker, pizza shop, in, where would it have been? I think in Maryland, in the US. And they've, as it's a chain, and they're now employing, I think, 1,300 fewer people than they did at the beginning of the pandemic because they just can't find people. But as a result, they're kind of reducing their numbers of toppings and doing much more online.
This is a case for pizza productivity.
So this is just one example, but you're seeing it everywhere that just, you know, companies have massively adapted. So each successive wave, and we've seen this, the impact on the economy has been progressively less. I think that's what's interesting. What I said at the start was actually this is because it's been so concentrated in a few weeks. Yeah. Omicron has actually managed to still have To go back to sort of 2020 levels of the sort of initial impact on activity. But we have, you know, every reason to believe that's going to fall off a cliff when everyone has got COVID.
So actually, economically, if what variants do is that they, one of the things we're seeing is obviously that they become significantly more transmissible over time. That's actually not bad for us on the economics, because it means these waves are just more short and sharp, if that's what happens in the UK. If that's what happens.
Well, and there's also the sense, I mean, the implication of some of what you're saying is that it's not exactly a herd immunity, but you do have that it becomes, we move more quickly, thanks to Omicron, to this kind of endemic period than maybe we would have done.
Yeah, fingers crossed. What do you think, Stephen, in terms of the politics of just on the pandemic itself? Because, I don't know, my like prior was always, people will be scared initially in the heat of the crisis. There'll then be a bit of gratitude that some light was at the end of the tunnel, which is basically vaccines, and it is important to remember that this time last year we were just starting vaccinating. If we'd gone back to like autumn 2020, we didn't even know for absolutely sure that vaccines could give us a way out of this, at least a lasting way out of it. So there was like, thank God there's a way out of this, and then politics basically just gets harder and harder as incumbents move further out of the acute phase. What do you reckon? Is that fair? Do you want an election soon after the pandemic if you're a government?
Yeah, I think you do, because it's not just this pandemic, right? If you think about, say, the 1950s polio epidemics or the sort of onset of HIV/AIDS in the West in the 80s, so broadly, even when you do not have the state going, don't go out, shut down, societies shut themselves down, there is some social and economic damage as a result. And then broadly, actually, after about 2 years, including 1918 influenza pandemic, people go, do you know what? This is I'm tired of this. I'll take my chances, and that of course becomes more ticklish for a government. Not least if you take the British example. Right, so actually, to take a personal example, I am one of the people who, one of the things COVID has really exposed to me is that I always have a perpetual cough. Why? Because I grew up and still live in inner London, so you know my lungs are lined with particulates. Now I cared about clean air quality before, but I care a lot more now than every time I get this persistent cough. I go, oh, it's fine. I don't have COVID. I just have the thing that's almost certainly actually going to kill me eventually. And you kind of see this with the NHS has coped fine, which is true. The NHS has coped about as well as it did in 2019, which we shouldn't forget was an election in which no party felt they could defend the status quo in the NHS. You had everyone competing, say, look, we know it's got problems, we'll put more money into it. Yeah. So I think it is a big difficulty for all governments to have this situation where people are chafing at restrictions, they want them to be over, but it does then expose and increase the salience of, you know, things like the condition of healthcare.
That is definitely true. Let's come back to the NHS and the politics of it. Right, there's a first poll for you guys at home to have a look at, which is your go at this projections. So will we ever need public health restrictions? Let's, like, mild ones, okay? We're not talking about, like, mad lockdowns, but, like, are the Resolution Foundation staff ever going to be asked to work at home again once this wave is through, not just because we've all had a massive row in the office, but because of the previous next wave. So, yes, get used to it. It's every winter. And it is important. We're all sounding relaxed.
Is this the coronavirus or other things?
You know, you're not allowed to predict future pandemics. Okay. No. We're on corona pandemics here. If you look back at some of the commentary at the time when Omicron kicked off, there were people writing columns. I'm not going to say they were in the FT, but some were in the FT, saying, "Get used to this. We're going to be like locking down. We're going to be doing mild lockdowns forever. Stop messing around with it." Basically because we thought it was more serious than it has now turned out to be, even though it's still very serious in terms of lots of people getting this thing. And they were saying, look, just plan for this being every winter. There'll be like a month and a half when you work from home if you're in a professional job, and there'll be, you know, we'll wear more masks, basically. And there were other people saying, like, what are you talking about? Like, get over it. And they've come out more right. Anyway, so this is your chance to have a vote on that. Will we ever do it again? Only occasionally means every other winter or something. Yeah, obviously they don't have to turn up during winter, but let's like assume the hemispheres do their job. Or are you like John and you basically think we're done and we're going to just get on with it and put up with like a bit of strain on the NHS when one of these comes along and we are... So while you vote on that, I just want to do the last two more questions on the pandemic itself, which people are asking. So John, you can take these both first. So one is on... There's a few questions on isolation, basically. Here we go. So which we haven't dealt with. So that question is about actual restrictions for the population as a general thing. The discussion is actually now moving to how big should the restrictions be for people with COVID, not for Djokovic. Yeah. Other people with COVID. He didn't care about it. He's been ignoring the restrictions all the way through.
Can you talk to magazines but not newspapers?
Exactly. Yeah. There's a very specific rule. If it's a magazine with a camera making you look good, you take your mask off, even if you've got COVID. If his lawyers are watching, this is allegedly...
I think he's banged the rights on them.
Oh, that one he's admitted to. Yeah. Right, okay, fine. But he didn't pollute the kids intentionally. Okay. Right, so, John, are we going to have scrapped the isolation rules by May?
I don't think we will have... the UK will have scrapped them outright. I think South Africa is an interesting example on this because they, just before Christmas, I think it was, or between Christmas and New Year, announced that they were essentially scrapping isolation for people who were not symptomatic. But there was then quite a bit of pushback from that domestically, and they had to roll that back a week or so later. So I think I can imagine some countries saying, if you don't have symptoms, then we're not going to require isolation, or at least then we're going to say you need to, let's say you need two or three successive days of testing negative, and then you can go and then you're out. So I think certainly we'll move increasingly to test to release rather than fixed isolation terms.
That will still be quite a lot of isolation. Like, yeah, you're still going to be 6-7 days in loads of cases.
Yeah, or I think, you know, it may be something like if you have symptoms, you need to get all these successive negative tests. If you don't, then perhaps there's no requirement at all. I can't speak to whether that would be necessarily like a good idea. There is interesting research on this showing that somewhere between 5 and 7 days is probably optimal in terms of minimising both isolation and infections. So I think we are going to see more countries go either from 10 to 7 or 7 to 5. But yeah, I think the South African example shows that there are a lot of people who are going to react negatively to that and say that it's sort of it's needlessly lax. And so I think this may end up, like most things in the pandemic, being a political question.
So you think that could be the next restrictions? When they're like Tory X, the people that want to be anti-climate action and wanted to be anti-restrictions, their next thing is going to be there should be isolation, should only be a few days or whatever, rather than... Because there's no restrictions left to row about, basically.
Yeah. That will be the next sort of front of that fight, yeah.
Okay. Deprivation, which someone is rightly raising here, which is, so taking the pandemic as a whole, we know that deprived areas, not just in the north of England, but particularly bits of the northwest and some bits of London, you've definitely seen very high case rates and death rates. And you'll get the same thing if you look by earnings decile, and you get a similar picture if you look by ethnicity, you get very different death rates. What's our like lesson from that?
That's a really good question, because really this has been, kind of as the question makes out, this is revealing something that's always been there. And I think, you know, if we tracked mortality from all causes, not just COVID, routinely, you know, if that was in the news every day, every week, we would see this same story all the time. So I don't know, to be honest, what specific actions need to be taken here, because this is something that has been, for anyone who's looked at this has been known about since you know,
forever.
Yeah, forever. You know, the original Marmot report was, there were things done decades ago.
I mean, it's in Dickens. So it's not like you haven't got to wait for Marmot to turn up in 2010. Like.
Yeah. So I genuinely don't know. I don't know what, if a pandemic where this is in the headlines every day doesn't lead to action being taken, I don't know.
What do you think, Stephen, on the like, because it is weird, isn't it? Like, I can't remember any news reporting of really large differences in death rates. I mean, every now and again, someone would draw a map of London and show you like the death rates in Kensington versus Dagenham.
Life expectancy, people used to
a bit. A so life expectancy, we had a tick up of a bit of discussion of like, yeah, big variations.
10-year difference.
But it's not a big feature of our politics, is it really? And it's death. I mean, it's not like, you know, we do talk about differences in like earnings growth of like 0.5% between parts of the income distribution, but actual deaths aren't a big part until the pandemic turns up.
Well, this, I think, is partly a consequence of the fact that the era of being an actual democracy in most of the world coincides with the era of death not being that, being a thing which happens at the end of life, people don't like to think about it, and it's therefore something which is not discussed. And it does, you know, I promise I'm not going to pivot every answer back to the NHS, but it comes back to this slight weirdness of our current situation where we're going, don't worry, it's fine, we will shut down large parts of society if I break my leg and I might be next to someone who has COVID who's broken their thumb, but we don't shut down healthcare capacity if I break my leg and I'm next to someone in A&E who's having a psychotic episode. We accept that as part of the normal way the NHS runs after a decade of, you know, below average increases in how much is spent on it. I do suspect an underrated political dynamic of the sort of return to normality, because the interesting thing about the previous question, right, is, well, people who work in retail, in some NHS care trusts, in some schools are already essentially being told, look, if you're asymptomatic, whatever you do, don't put that swab in your mouth. And I think the weird thing is I suspect if you looked at the South African economy as it really exists, loads of people are now going, well, I'm asymptomatic, so I'm not testing, I'm asymptomatic, so I'm not isolating. And I suspect that whether by law or simply by the facts on the ground, most of the Western world, including the United Kingdom, will, you know, be South Africa, whether by legal or actual changes. But these things do all increase the salience of a thing that we mostly don't like to talk about, which is the slightly grubby decisions that get made in the NHS all the time. And that, I think, is going to be a political challenge for both parties. It's obviously a challenge for the Conservatives because it raises the difficult issues they're already having over tax. And it's a challenge for Labour because although they are very clear on what their answer is, it does get back to that long-run anxiety people have about the Labour Party that their solution to everything is just to throw money at it.
So even on the things where it might be the right answer, it's socially awkward.
I just think, I mean, part of the other problem is that all of our conversations around this always do centre around the NHS. And actually, as we all know, all of those health inequalities actually almost entirely relate to things that are not to do with NHS policy at all. Yep. So public health, you know, we have a whole debate about the NHS. It won't have any difference, won't make any difference at all if actually it's more fundamentally around differences in education, differences in environmental pollution, all of the things that you were talking about. So, you know, that until you, you know, the levelling up agenda, you know, if we ever got a white paper and if they actually, this government ever took it seriously.
It's coming. Michael Gove's got it sorted.
I feel sorry for, I have my colleagues in Bloomberg, I'm waiting for I told them wait for the white paper before we did our levelling up indicator.
Oh yeah.
And they've had to wait a really long time. We have to come up with the government's own view of levelling up. But you know, if they did take that seriously, it could potentially make this, you know, difference in death rates, part of a broader conversation that wasn't just postcode lottery, you know, that is actually about the underlying causes of health and social differences.
Yeah. Although we are rubbish at that. I mean, like, you know, all of our New Year's resolutions about cake, but like our obesity level is just like up every year consistently for like 30 years.
Everybody's pretty bad at it.
We're all bad at it. We're going to eat the cake, whatever. And I include myself in the cake eating group. Right, let's move on to the economics, where they've got, well, first of all, we should bring up the results of the poll and then we'll go to the economics. So what was your level of perkiness? You and John were all done. No, John, did you see? They're going to get. They want some restrictions. that is interesting, and that's a very high percentage of you. 70% think basically we're going to be doing it every now and again because something bad will turn up. And what there is, I haven't done justice to all the questions at all here, but there's some of them asking about super variants or like other, or as you say, like new pandemics turning up. Although it is, although I do, you know, after the banking crisis, everyone spent all their columns writing about how we'll get another banking crisis was imminent, and that wasn't just Vince Cable, because that was the thing he always wanted to say. So everyone always assumes the next major trauma will be the same as the one that we've just been through. The
difference is we do get a new zoonotic disease through, weird things about the people who get obsessing about the lab leak stuff is, what are the two pandemic risks? Agri-food and globalisation and poor biosecurity. Yeah, and it's one of those things where going, like, well, which one was it last time? It's sort of a bit pointless. It's like going, am I going to be hit by a red car or a yellow car? It's like, I mean, I still want to go to hospital afterwards.
Do with both of them. Okay, all right. Fine, right. You've certainly thrown me off with your red and yellow cars. Right, let's do the economics slightly. So there's a lot of moving parts here. And one of the weird things about the economics debate at the moment is partly it kind of does tend to be, you know, we've got interest rates, we've got withdrawal of support, we've got inflation crisis, we've got Brexit, we've got what's happening to productivity after the pandemic, all these bits. And the public debate is basically zeroing in on one at a time. And then usually that one gets extrapolated to be the thing that will determine everything for the economy for the next like 20 years or something. So like when inflation's in the news, it's all about like we're back to the 70s. Or when everyone is saying, writing their puff pieces on how firms have become so much more productive because of the pandemic, it's all going to be sunny uplands. So we're going to try, we need to try, Stephanie, to like integrate some of these. But unfortunately, the questions don't do that easily for us. But let's do some. Let me find the because no, we don't want to do that yet. Well, I can't find the ones that I'm looking for. So let's do interest rates, which was like the big thing just before Christmas, and is now completely disappeared from all UK discussions. Although if you read the US papers, you would be getting more. And if you look at what's happening in financial markets more generally, forget what central banks are doing, but like financial markets are starting to both calm down about long-term inflation and expect higher rates basically to be the norm. So do you think it's going to like hove back into view as something people care about?
There'll be I actually do think the energy price rise is so enormous that until we kind of get some kind of resolution about what's going to happen with that, that it's quite reasonable for people to be mainly focused on, if my energy bill's going to
go up by 50% or
the, certainly the price of energy is going to go up by 50%.
Yeah.
But that aside, I mean, we obviously will have, there'll be, you've had this Bank of England very small rate rise. I think we still don't think interest rates will be 1%, I mean, in terms of the bank rate, by the end of the year, or they may be at 1%. So we should, you know, even with our, you know, collective long memories.
So the rate of change is up, but the level is low, basically.
So you have quite rapid change. I mean, if you think of it in context, I think pre-global financial crisis, the average rate of increase that the Federal Reserve did in any given cycle when they were tightening was something like 2.5 percentage points a year. So the idea that, you know, 1 percentage point in a year is like a rapid pace of tightening was not true. You know, obviously in relative terms, you know, rates are very low now, so you could say you didn't, you also didn't have, you know, an increase, a doubling of rates or whatever. But I do think, if you're just looking at the path, it doesn't feel like what is expected now is going to be a major blow to the economy. I think it's for the Bank of England and for others, it's a little bit about this timing. You know, do they try and get, they're facing two risks. They face the risk of seeming to be losing control of inflation, which then has its own cost because people maybe start changing their expectations down the road. Yeah. You know, if you don't basically think that Bank of England has got it under control, then maybe you do see more in a very tight labour market. Then maybe you do start to see more pickup in wage growth.
Yeah.
Maybe service sector prices carry on rising a bit. Now, one thing I would say is all of the, you know, the mistakes, the forecasting errors to defend central banks for a minute. When you look back and say, okay, what was the forecast error on inflation last year? Almost all of it is explained by the unexpected increase in energy prices. So it isn't actually that they underestimated the stuff. You're right that there was.
By the middle of the year,
absolutely.
You're right. Early in the year,
but
that's fair enough.
If you go back to the sort of beginning of the year forecasts,
yeah,
it was almost all, pretty much all actually, the energy price rise. As we've now, the mistakes, the errors that we're getting now in, you know, when inflation's coming through versus forecasts, whether it's Bank of England or anybody else, have actually been more on service sector prices, which suggests that actually we're getting a lot of, the energy price rises are being pushed through much faster, and other price rises are being pushed through to consumers to a much greater extent than we've seen in the past.
And in a more concentrated,
and that's
UK,
kind
in a
of
really
interesting as well, because
period.
Companies often are coining it at the moment. They have really high profit margins, and they're not taking any of this on their margins. You know, they're still forecasting this great profit growth and the price growth. So that is one interesting question for British politics. It is a completely unseen element of British politics that people start talking about gouging and start complaining about companies, apart from energy prices. You're allowed to be really cross with banks,
yeah,
banks and energy companies for
That's
making money, but by and large, we don't slag off other businesses,
even PPE
for
providers,
having really high profit margins, unless they happen to be, you know, married to a Tory MP. But, you know, in the US, there has actually been,
yeah,
a whole line of argument with the Biden administration about, you know, we need much more competition policy, in part because these, you know, companies are sort of taking advantage of the public,
yeah,
and not taking enough of these price rises on their margins. So I think we could see that dynamic if inflation carries on and people, and we do have a squeeze in living standards, but somehow businesses are still passing on all these price rises.
Yeah. Let's take another poll, which is basic, and then Stephen can take this into, we can talk about the Prime Minister's high-wage economy plan, which is only a few months old, but everyone's forgotten about it. Right, so next Christmas, what are we really going to be doing, okay? What you're all going to be doing, hopefully being able to like go home without having to isolate a week in advance. But anyway, celebrating easing inflation, so that's basically the central bank's forecast will turn out
does
to be
that
right.
That's like at your house. But ooh, let us all celebrate.
It doesn't say on Christmas Day. It doesn't say over the sherry. I just mean at come Christmas time, what will people who care about the economy? That's very unconstructive, Stephanie. Right, look, is it going to be celebrating easing inflation? The forecast will turn out to be right. It was temporary. Calm down, everybody. Will it be celebrating big pay rises, which basically means inflation will have come down and the Prime Minister will have turned out to be right and we'll get like booming pay rises as we come out of the pandemic because they've all been stored up and we've got new productivity growth and wages. Workers are all in short demand, high demand. Will we be, in fact, doing the opposite and worrying about high inflation and high pay rises? So this is like Stephanie's worst case scenario, Larry Summers scenario, where workers, they've got loads of market power, they're really pissed off about prices going up and they demand pay rises, but we haven't got productivity rises to match them. And so we get into a good old-fashioned price-wage spiral that everyone calls a wage-price spiral because it reads better, but is the wrong way around. This is all going to be nonsense. We're going to be worrying about something entirely else. I don't know, the fact that the UK hasn't got any productivity growth at all might be a good place to start. Steve, what do you think is going on? Because if you go back just, it may even be 2 months, maybe 2.5. Basically, Boris Johnson did have an economic argument, which is like, look at the nominal average wage growth. It's really strong. Everyone knows there's no HGV drivers because I got rid of the migrants / COVID helped on that front. And that is the new higher wage economy we've got to build. Where's it all gone? What's going to happen? How does this fit with the politics?
Well, the high wage economy thing was always a bit of a kind of, here's the thing that we've said to get out of a difficult interview, and now we all have to pretend that this is a serious big idea for the whole of our party conference, right? But that kind of, the underlying problem actually is that the Conservatives probably really do not want to be a high wage economy party, because if you kind of actually ignore the inflation issue and you know, kind of cast your mind back to the pre-financial crisis, we had, yes, much higher interest rates, but also higher rates of growth. And I suspect, and when you talk to quite a lot of thinking Conservative MPs, they kind of go, look, probably the reason why we have, you know, some of our economic problems are because interest rates continue to bump along at very, very low levels. But the thing which does unite, and I think we underrate the extent to which it is still about economics, but the thing which unites the Conservatives coalition isn't that they all love Boris Johnson, because that wasn't true in 2019 and is even more not true now. It is whether they are, you know, two young homeowners in Dudley with a help to buy mortgage and 5% of equity, or they are a buy-to-let landlord who has bought three properties, or they are just an ordinary homeowner in Surrey, that they have got quite used to a decade of ultra to low interest rates. And yes, of course, it's true that it's a tiny rise in sort of historical terms.
Yep.
But if you are 5 years into your 300k worth of debt on your Barrett home, it doesn't feel tiny. It is a never yet seen event. I do suspect that the stuff about interest rates and a return to something which looks more like normality will probably be the thing which comes back into British political discourse, because for them they do have, I do think one of the underlying Conservative problems is that their economic interests are in sort of low to stagnant growth, but that's actually is a very hard line to thread between an economy that is growing just enough that you don't end up having to raise taxes in the way Rishi Sunak is doing, but not so much that you have interest rate rises, which do, I think, cause problems for the Conservative electoral coalition.
Okay, very good. I think that goes into the worrying about something else entirely bucket, at least on the political side of it. Before we come back to the results of that, while you're all voting away at home, Stephanie, why don't we do this, which is, this is specifically on cities, this question here, which is basically saying, there was lots of like pop pieces about everyone leaving cities. There's now some even funnier pieces being written about numpties coming back into cities who like turns out they didn't like mud or something. But let's broaden this question out slightly into, so which bits of kind of pandemic economic change do we think are permanent and which can we just like forget about, basically?
I mean, I do think, actually, I think the future of cities, the future of urban areas is fascinating, because you've certainly seen in the US, you've maybe got more evidence of this move out of the centre of cities. And there's lots of anecdotal, but you're also seeing it in the property market. So some of that structural change, I think, will happen. I think what is really interesting to me is what does that do to the geography of the labour market, particularly when you think about all of those low-wage service sector jobs that are effectively there to service an mm-hmm. affluent high-skill worker. And it's obviously we talk about the Pretz and the coffee shops and other things, but it's a whole raft of things
facilities
that have built
management.
Up even and have also built up around you know, those who came back to live in a Clerkenwell loft or something, you know, who have a very affluent lifestyle, they've got, you know, a network of people around them who are working for them. If they go out to the suburbs where it's actually really hard to travel if you're living in a low, you know, in a different part of London, then, you know, what does it do to that balance of jobs, the sort of home-based jobs, the gardeners, all the things mm-hmm. that we think are the future of the labour market for a lot of people. So I think trying to get a handle on that is going to be particularly hard for the government because they've got a slightly incoherent approach to towns and cities at the moment, where Boris has just sort of said, well, we're going to bring the jobs to the left behind, or the held back towns don't have to be dormitory towns for Manchester or other major cities. They can have their own jobs. And you sort of, you know, we were all left wondering how on earth that was going to happen. But it is... It is an interesting moment because we sort of thought we knew where we were, and that would have been at least what the government would be sort of thinking, you know, that would be organising the government's thoughts. And now they're supposedly coming back with an answer to some of this when we don't actually know where the future is.
So, Stephen, this question is pushing us onto 2022 in particular. And one of the, like, politics, on it, this place-based politics, insofar as it interacts with economics, goes through phases where, like, in the mid-2010s, it was city-focused in its narrative. Northern Powerhouse was basically Manchester-dominated with a bit of role for Leeds and others. Greater Manchester, I shouldn't say, not Manchester itself. And then we've got into a towns phase more recently because politics has pushed us there because of where marginal seats happen to sit. Where do you think we're going to shake out in terms of... Because our politics has changed with more voice for... But the voice... The non-Westminster voices have either become Scotland, Wales or big cities... That's where we've gone, but the debate has shifted on to not cities. Where are we going to end up on our cities, towns world?
Well, yeah, because the central reason for that change, right, was that the vision George Osborne had was that it would make Manchester Central vote like Battersea. Yeah. And the political change has been that Battersea has started to vote like Manchester Central, and so it no longer seems like a good idea to try and create... more. But yeah, there was this idea, we should forget, that the Conservative majority would come from that affluent ring of London seats. And I think in some ways, right, if you take the longer view, people are bet against cities, including, you know, London declined. One of the reasons why I get kind of quite sort of stentorian when people go, oh, it's all great. London declined throughout the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
But if you look over the longer view, everyone who bets against cities loses their shirts. And I think that will continue to be the case. But the difficulty this government will have is that they are, as Stephanie said, they're confused. They can't work out, do they want to go, oh, what's great for High Peak, isn't it, continues to be a Manchester suburb? Or to go, oh, well, no, some magical event will happen, which will mean that there will, I don't know, be a factory in High Peak making green, making climate capture and storage? Yeah, so I think what will end up happening is just as we saw towards the end of the 2015 period, you know, very traditional stimulus spending on roads, bypasses, and all of that kind of thing, just in a bid to gin up growth before the elections, we will kind of see a drift back to the economics of the Northern Powerhouse because they broadly do make sense. We will be more hybrid, but actually in a hybrid era, the ability to get into the office on the rare opportunities when you suddenly have to, or when the boss goes, actually, we need to have an in-person meeting, I think that becomes more valuable, not less. But the challenge for cities in 2022 specifically will be being in this weird, awkward halfway house where the economics line up for them, but the politics don't. And it's also true of university towns, which actually, again, if you want to regenerate a left-behind area, what has been the big transformative thing in lots of places, it has been the expansion of higher education and what that has done to city centres. But the government hates those because they also create people who vote for Labour or the Liberal Democrats.
Well, to be tried, to be fair, they're worried they cost quite a lot of money as well. But but yeah, that is the politics of it. More broadly, what do you think is going to last? The economic changes that the pandemic gave us?
I sort of hear what, or agree with what Stephanie was saying in terms of with each successive wave, just as just as the realised severity in terms of public health is smaller, so is the economic impact. And I think we're really getting to the stage where, you know, if there's another wave at some point this year or next winter, I think it would have progressively less impact than it's had so far. So, you know, people have got much more used to getting takeaways. Businesses, as you were saying, have become much more flexible. You know, the areas that I think have suffered the most are anything attached to workplaces, because obviously when you have people staying away from offices, all of those, the literal retailers like newsagents, cafes, in places like Canary Wharf. I mean, no one's ever felt sorry for Canary Wharf before, but or, you know, central London, have just completely lost all of their business. And it's still not clear, even now, as people start coming back to work, in what volumes they're coming back. You know, the FT's talking about everyone getting back to work, but not necessarily 5 days a week. And so you could still be talking about 40, 50, 60% of those businesses' incomes not coming back. So I think that's going to be, just in the medium term, the really interesting transition is, if we see a return to the workplace, but not all the time, does that mean some of these small businesses around big sort of commercial areas, it's no longer viable? And yeah, what does that look like?
We're definitely getting some of that going on. Right, let's move on to let's bring up the results of the poll, and then I'm going to use that to pivot into the politics, which we're then going to overrun drastically. So what did you all think was going to happen? What are you all going to be worrying about? Not over your Christmas dinner, when it's how you overcook the turkey. You're all worrying about something else, or you're not a lot of celebrating going on in general. I think I'm a bit more optimistic. I think we might be having, we won't have got back down to 2% inflation, but I think we might be looking at calming down on our inflation anxieties by this time next year, despite still paying large energy bills, I should say. Okay, worrying about something else. I'm going to put that down to you all very worried about kind of Brexit, productivity, UK sluggish growth.
You should have had all of the above. I think economists are certainly capable of celebrating all of these things and worrying about
looking. Okay, well, they need to stop, Stephanie. Right, okay, I want to use Brexit to pivot, because there's lots of Brexit questions that we're not going to have time to do justice to. But there's one here saying, basically, what's Brexit going to do? Here we go. What's Brexit going to do? Steve, why don't you take this first? What's Brexit going to do to our economic... Let's focus on the politics. So basically, one of the big switches in the last month and a half is Boris, at least internally, has made up his mind that he doesn't want a massive trade war, and that in the end, this thing needs solving. He wants to solve Northern Ireland, not politicise Northern Ireland in the long run. Or maybe that's too optimistic. But anyway, what's going to happen? Is it all going to calm down?
Well, I think it's still uncertain. You know, is what we saw a kind of... the British government essentially saying it will always ultimately blink on this issue and going, actually, you know, we prefer this to the alternative, or is this kind of just a temporary pause? I think the underlying political pressure is people do not want to have to hear about Brexit anymore. And in some ways, the weird way that the OBR is sort of now no party's friend is sort of every budget now, they are going to pop up and go, still doing economic damage, despite the fact that the Conservative Party wants to say Brexit's going well and the Labour Party wants to go Brexit. What's that? Is that the meal at the start of the day? We have no opinions on it. And so that will continue to shape politics here. I think we shouldn't underestimate how much the fact that we still don't quite know what the government actually wants to do with the Northern Ireland Protocol. Will be a long-run problem in terms of low productivity growth, low investment, etc. Like all of the kind of, it's not just...
Because we can't normalise the relationship with the EU.
It's not just the creation of more formal barriers. It is the creation of an environment in which there is no incentive to ease informal barriers. So I think, the difficulty is both parties want Brexit to go away. And
substance makes that hard.
Yeah, it's hard to see how that...
So basically life is going to make it hard for them to get what they want, which is a good lesson for life in general. Right, Stephanie, why don't we... Matt Gardner got an intriguing question here, which is, we're in a slightly weird situation where the Prime Minister is basically, like, underlying, apart from the, like, possibly lying about parties problem that he's now dealing with, what's really hard for the Prime Minister is he's putting up taxes, there's a cost of living squeeze going on, politics is difficult in that environment. The Chancellor, who is obviously on the betting numbers, the person most likely to succeed him, is obviously the one that announced those tax rises, even if the Prime Minister basically kind of made him do it for social care-related reasons. Do we think a Chancellor who's now thinking, well, maybe it turns out that this is happening rather sooner than I thought, has a strong incentive to do something about these tax rises.
The question of whether the NI rise will be removed or the uplift to universal credit will be restored. I mean, I don't think, and certainly from the brief conversations I have had with him, but also from everything, I'm sure Stephen will tell us anything, he's vested so much in actually pushing through that restoration, back to normal of the universal credit. I don't think
that's definitely not
going to happen. That happened. I think the NI thing is difficult, and there is the fact that it is tied to the NHS and somehow solving the social care crisis, I think, is a real problem, because if you get rid of it, you're basically saying that that's not important anymore. The fact that it was never going to solve either of those problems is sort of, by the by, but you're stuck with that. So I suspect he will try and find some other way. I mean, maybe you delay the NI rise, but I think they'll find something that's a bit more specific. I wouldn't rule out some kind of windfall tax, but the money involved is so significant that I think you also have to do something that's much more household-based.
Yeah. There's another, John Bryant has got a version of this question, which is, if a Tory leadership campaign actually kicks off, and that happens before April, I think it's unlikely, but it could happen, clearly, judging by people, the news coverage overnight, are Tories not going to end up promising to scrap it just to get through the leadership campaign? Well, go on, Stephen, what do you think?
Well, this is a great question, because what is the subtext of everything Liz Truss says and does? It is, I am more economically liberal and traditional than him. I cleverly use the equalities brief to signal to the right that I'm also one of them on the cultural stuff, but I'm a bit unorthodox, and that is code for I would be more relaxed about borrowing than the Iron Chancellor over here. Yeah, right. And what is the subtext of Rishi Sunak's messaging? It's, I am a return to the era of fiscal prudence and tax cuts. The issue, of course, is he cannot possibly sell that message while not also being the candidate of tax rises under this Prime Minister, because you have to. He thinks that the way the Conservatives win is by getting onto that ground of Conservative frugality and Labour spendthriftness. And in terms of what the Prime Minister wants, that means being a tax raising Chancellor. And so I think this is actually one reason. If it turns out we're all comically wrong and Boris Johnson is still Prime Minister by the end of the year, it will precisely be because the economics. The actual economics and the economics as desired by a chunk of the parliamentary party and a large chunk of the activist base in associations, then the task of reconciling that is just so unpleasant for all of the would-be contenders. They'd just rather wait and let it be Boris Johnson's problem.
Okay, that's a really good way of thinking about it. Bring up the last poll question, which is gets this. I'm going to come back to a question which directly gets this, which is totally unfairly. Who's going to win the next election? I'm going to make you all have an answer to this. You get three Tories to choose from.
Wait, hang on. So Nicola Sturgeon might win no matter what.
That's a joke. That's as close as you get to a comedy in the Resolution Foundation. She might do really well out of it. She'll almost certainly win in Scotland, but she's probably not going to stand candidates in Cornwall. So who's going to win? Boris Johnson, because for whatever reason, everyone calms down, the current thing passes, and people decide, given the coalition we're trying to put together, it's better than anything else on the table. Liz Truss, because people want freedom and trade deals. Rishi Sunak, because they want fiscal prudence. Keir Starmer, because they fancy a change. Or Nicola Sturgeon, if you're one of the kind of rebels out there. Obviously, other options are available. We're a neutral charity. So in your head, you can vote for whoever you want, but we don't let you to vote for whoever you want. What do people think? Come on, Stephen. Who's going to win?
I think it'll be Liz Truss. I have never bought the idea that despite the Chancellor's, undoubted political skills, he's, personally very warm, which obviously helps in a parliamentary democracy, and MPs like you, but I have never really bought the idea that the Prime Minister could get in sufficient trouble to be got rid of in this Parliament without the Chancellor being caught in the contagion, and I still...
This is your long-term point. If you live next door, you get something.
I just still can't conceive of how that can work.
Okay, John?
I sort of agree with everything Stephen's saying, but just to make it interesting, I'll say I still think it could be Sunak. I think people, not necessarily Tory members, but people seem to like him. I think people who pay less attention to the minute details still seem to think he's, nice guy, something new, something different.
And he paid a lot of their wages.
Absolutely. I think that very sort of airy-fairy sense of things often plays a bigger impact than some of the details.
What do you reckon?
I think, well, it's a bit easy. It's easier for me to say I don't think it will be Rishi, because not just partly for your reasons, but also that I just think in general he's the way any conceivable removal of Boris, even if it's not around the parties, he will also, if he isn't implicated, he will look rather slippery. So it kind of goes both ways. He's either in it or he's not in it. But either way, you're kind of like, do you trust this guy? And he has got, you know, all of the sort of baggage of the billionaires, you know, the other things, I think also don't play very well, even though he comes across.
But they didn't
well
trust, you know.
But I do think it's interesting, Johnson, that none of us seem to think that there's even the remotest chance that Keir Starmer.
Well, I would have ought
to get to the point where at least Keir Starmer would give Liz Truss a run for
right,
money.
Well, on that note, let's bring up the results of the poll, because we're obviously already overrunning. And the let's see what the.
From your very representative
punters,
sample.
This is literally as good as polling gets, people. There you go. Right. Yeah, so now, okay. Keir Starmer's is the highest percentage result.
Yeah, but
add together the Tories. Yeah. The Tories are at 50%. So you've still got, it's more likely to be a Tory victory than Labour victory from this incredibly scientific survey. But people are very evenly split on Liz versus Rishi. But the betting markets are still heavily on Rishi.
Yeah, I mean, the betting market's always a lagging indicator, not least because, I'm not going to get...
It's a good advert for reading columns, you see, because you're ahead of the betting markets.
Yeah, they are always, I mean, the betting markets are always, they're interesting, but they're always a bit full. I think I kind of see the logic of that result in some ways, right, in that, his numbers are in the kind of Cameron-y zone, right, where he could do it. Mm-hmm. It's a really long way back. But of course, he has a better individual chance than any of the named Conservative candidates, right?
He hasn't got a win a leash,
he's probably. I would rather be him than any one of those individual Tories, but I would rather be the generic to Conservative candidate to be Prime Minister next time.
Very good. Okay, look, I think everyone's going to agree on that. Let's wrap up with one last question for each of you, which is, as I said, going back to our Marxism, which is like, what's going to dominate? So the pandemic has definitely dominated economics and politics for the last 2 years because it keeps driving it basically in different ways. The economics has started to come back in. The cost of living thing is definitely like currently dominating the politics, but a load of volatility has just turned up on the politics front. So which one, at the end of this year, are we going to think that was a good old-fashioned Bill Clinton, the economy-dominated year? Is it another pandemic year? Just 2022, is it going to be about the pandemic? Is it going to be about the politics? Is it going to be about the economics? Is the end fair? And try not to go just with your vested interest in, like, if we want to keep up demand for threads on the pandemic, there's going to have to be a pandemic going on. But you can do equally good data threads on the economy, John. I've seen them before. So, John, what do you reckon? What's going to dominate?
Politics.
Cool.
I just think there seems to be an increasing sort of appetite among the wider public for pursuing this further. I think I actually thought the party stuff, the lowercase p party stuff, would play less strongly or less long than it has done. I think there's going to be more of that. And I think if it does obviously turn into some kind of genuine leadership tussle, that would naturally, I think...
That could take most of the year if it played that long. Okay, very good. Stephen, which one is it?
I think it will be the cost of living.
Your economics. Yeah. So says Resolution Foundation year look ahead over the Christmas period. So we have a vested interest in that being the case. Stephanie?
50% increase in energy prices, which is not going away.
So you are, the Marxist, basically.
Well, but I think, so it's all overdetermined. But I actually think we'll be lucky if, you know, I think there's a possibility that we'll be able to focus on politics, but that will mean that the economics is
Putin turns on the gas, he sorts out our inflation problem, and then people worry about who's the leader of the Conservative Party instead, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, Putin could have a lot of say, I think, in what we're focused on in a few months.
That is a very good point, but that's really depressing. So let's not end on the global geopolitical tensions, because that takes us down a whole other neck of the woods. Look, I will say thank you
next
to the panel.
That's
next week's non-Resolution Foundation event on politics today. So thank you very much to the panel for lots of thoughts, bravely making predictions. Yeah, so anyone turning up and making predictions given the last 3 years deserves a lot of credit for boldness and braveness. And thank you all for listening. There was loads of brilliant questions, and I apologize I didn't do justice to all of them. And I look forward to seeing you at a Resolution Foundation webinar soon. Have a good day and a good year, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this Resolution Foundation event. You can find more episodes and the latest living standards research on the Resolution Foundation website.